Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The recent NCAA sanctions against Penn State once again have inspired many to question the organization's authority in much the same way that critics questioned it about a year ago when sanctions were dished up for OSU over the tattoos for memorabilia scandal, followed by the revelations that then-coach Jim Tressel had feigned ignorance of the improper transactions. So just how much power does the NCAA wield and by what authority? Joining us now to talk about that is someone who covers Big Ten sports and by that way, the NCAA, Columbus Dispatch sports reporter Bill Rabinowitz. Welcome to the show, Bill.
Hi, Ann. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you. You are in Chicago reporting on the Big Ten's annual media days.
Yes, I am.
Is this a topic of conversation?
I'm sure it'll be the topic of conversation. What's interesting is that, you know, when Urban Meyer was hired in November, I think most people would have thought, well, when Urban Meyer shows up at the Big Ten media days, it's going to be he's going to be the main attraction. Well, he's not going to be. And in fact, Penn State isn't even bringing players here. Usually, always actually, teams bring three players, usually seniors, to act as representatives for the school. And Penn State has decided not to bring their players. So it's all going to be on Bill O'Brien's shoulders. And yeah, there's no question that Penn State is the story here.
It, you know, I've been reading excerpts from Taylor Branch's new book called The Cartel, Inside the Rise and Imminent Fall of the NCAA. And in doing that, in reading that, it's sort of shocking the way he lays it all out, all of the different kinds of problems college sports have had in maybe the last 10 years.
Yeah, there's no question that the last, I would say it's probably hit a, you know, reached kind of a peak in the last couple of years. First, you thought the Ohio State thing was the end of the world, and then there were allegations about Miami in Florida with a rogue booster. And then, obviously, the Penn State scandal has unfortunately blown everything out of the water. It's the biggest scandal in college sports. And so there's no question that there are a lot of problems with college sports, and some of it's inherent. There's so much pressure to win, and there's so much you know, the players are not getting paid. They certainly are not allowed to get paid. But there's so many gray areas. And I did stories. I mean, I'm the Ohio State football beat writer now. But before that, I was more the national college football writer and took a look at issues. And one of the stories was about just the gray area in the NCAA rules. And even enforcement people would say, we don't know the rules or they're impossible to understand all the rules. So if even the people in charge of enforcement and compliance aren't sure about things, it makes it very difficult for everybody.
My guest is Bill Rabinowitz, covers Ohio State football for the Columbus Dispatch. He's in Chicago right now, Big Ten Media Days. Joining us now is Taylor Branch, sports journalist and Pulitzer Prize-winning author. His latest book is called The Cartel, Inside the Rise and Imminent Fall of the NCAA. Welcome to the show, Taylor.
Thank you, Ann. Nice to be here.
There is a fairy tale version of the founding of the NCAA and the version you describe in your book. Well, actually, you describe both, the fairy tale and what you see as the real life version. Where did the NCAA come from, and how did it get to the point that it could afford a $50 million headquarters in Indianapolis?
And there are construction cranes to enlarge it far, far, far more.
Even as we speak.
Even as we speak, yes. The NCAA was founded in 1906, partly by the leadership of President Theodore Roosevelt. The fairy tale version was that Roosevelt was offended by all the kids dying in college football because back then they didn't even wear helmets. They refused to wear helmets and were getting killed right and left. The fact is that Roosevelt famously loved such social Darwinist conflict. What he was upset by was the fact that Yale kept beating his beloved Harvard team, and Walter Camp of Yale was in charge of the rules for college football. And he brought all the college presidents together at a time when football was concentrated in the Ivy League in 1906 and said, basically, if you want to survive, I want you to clean up, and created the NCAA and managed to substitute a Harvard coach for the Yale guy in charge of the rules, hoping that this would help Harvard beat Yale. So it's a little grittier story, but that's how the NCAA got started. Not until 1939 did it have the power even to mandate that college football players wear helmets. had no money, no power whatsoever until after World War II. And the power of the NCAA is kind of a fluke, an amazing one, because the NCAA's founder, Walter Byers, convinced all of college sports that the infant new television, newfangled invention, was going to kill college sports if it wasn't tightly regulated, because people would stay home and watch TV for free and not pay tickets to the game. And on that premise, which is, you know, ludicrous in retrospect, because television is what has made zillionaires out of college sports programs, on that premise, the NCAA regulated all college sports broadcasts. Now, the football schools have sued and won the right to sell all the college games they want without giving the NCAA a cut. And the NCAA now survives solely on the money it gets from March Madness basketball, which is about $770 million for just running that one tournament every March.
And swag. And Ohio State pushed back on that as well.
Absolutely. It gets all of that money. When it gets the $771 million, it has to allocate it by heavily contentious formula to the teams that compete in the March Madness basketball tournament. Then it takes a hefty cut for itself to support its offices and in Indianapolis and its fleet of leased aircraft and everything else it has. And on top of that, it distributes several hundred million dollars to every one of the 1,200 member schools, right down to the tiniest little ones that don't generate any sports revenue at all. That money basically is the price the NCAA has to pay to speak for all of college athletics. The vast majority of those schools don't earn any income, and amateur rules are meaningless to them. If the athletes had all the rights to bargain, it wouldn't make any difference. Those schools would laugh if they demanded to be paid because there isn't any money. But for the 100 or so schools that generate millions of dollars on the backs of unpaid labor, the NCAA is hooked, and the colleges are hooked on generating free money, like a casino money, by imposing unpaid amateur status on the athletes who generate their revenue.
The Dispatch's Bill Rabinowitz just talked about the maze of rules how even people who work there aren't always sure what the rules are for and what they mean. And this is a culture of rulemaking. The founder or the guy that ended up bringing the NCAA into its kind of modern day state had rules about everything, even how they deported themselves in the office.
Absolutely. Where to stand near the water cooler, when the drapes should be drawn. He was a meticulous and very, very skillful bureaucrat, Walter Byers, the founder of the NCAA. Well, really, the rules are intricate. They're a maze, in part because they have no foundation in law. There's no law. You couldn't write a law to do what the NCAA does, which is to take a particular class, not only of citizens, but of students. I mean, most students can get a job. They can found Facebook. And they take it for granted that they can do whatever they can to make $1 million or to pay their tuition. They can be teachers. But for this one group of students alone, the athletes, the NCAA says not only can you not bargain or have any voice in the governance of the sport that you're essential for, but we will penalize you and blacken your name and call you unethical if your mother gets a Christmas card from a sports agent. Now, to have that kind of control requires a maze of rules, as Mr. Rabinowitz said. It's really, I don't know of any comparison outside of North Korea for that kind of social control over the athletes. They can't get a job, they can't work, they can get food stamps by an explicit rule, but they can't earn any money. And no benefits, no tangible benefits can flow to any of their relatives or anybody that might know them. They can't get a discounted tattoo, as occurred at Ohio State. So this kind of the maze substitutes for the fact that there's really no basic in logic or law for what the NCAA is doing.
And they perpetuate this because if not for those issues of student athletes and the ethics around student athletes, by the way, a term coined by the NCAA, if not for that, there wouldn't be any reason for the NCAA to exist. It exists for ethical reasons, or at least that's the perception.
Yes. The reason that it would exist would revert to what it was at the beginning, which is to administer tournaments and make the rules and train referees and hand out trophies. But the real reason it exists is to impose these amateur rules on the few big-time sports schools that generate all the revenue, not only for the NCAA, but for the coaches, the proliferation of coaches, the Taj Mahal training facilities, and also the non-revenue sports that are subsidized by fiat at all these major schools.
Who has tried to challenge the NCAA? I know players, or at least former players, have. Have any universities, I know former university officials, have criticized the NCAA? Where has anybody gotten with all of that?
Well, Georgia and Oklahoma filed a lawsuit that they won in the Supreme Court in 1984, calling the NCAA a monopoly because the NCAA would demanded to regulate the football broadcast, and they wanted to broadcast their own football games, and said, "This is America. We deserve the right to not cut the NCAA in, so that it's going to share our football revenue with 1,000 tiny little dippy schools." The head of the coach at Texas said, "We don't want Hofstra to tell Texas how to play football," and they won. Some years later, the NCAA tried to restrict pay for assistant coaches, and the assistant coaches sued and said, "This is America. You can't regulate our rights." And they won at this in the Supreme Court and collected $50 million from the NCAA, and now you have million-dollar assistant coaches. So everywhere adults have challenged the pretense that the NCAA has to regulate sports, they won. But the last bastion for the NCAA is its rule that it's not sanctioned in law, that the athletes themselves are amateurs because the NCAA says so. And therefore, they not only can't bargain for compensation, but they can't have a voice at the table the way Olympic athletes do on all the Olympic, the 39 Olympic committees. Mm-hmm. They sit at the table when the rules are made over how to govern the sport.
Is there any appeals process?
A heavily rigged appeals process in which there is no due process. There again, that's another right. Beside representation and appeal, due process, the NCAA went to the Supreme Court to get itself exempted from any due process obligations to students in disciplinary proceedings. Basically, the students are peons. They are stripped of every right that the rest of us take for granted in the name of amateurism, and the rest of us so far have been dewy-eyed enough to fall for that. And it's the way it used to be for the Olympics, which were even more amateur than college sports. In fact, the Olympics used to say that college sports are already professional because they allow scholarships for the athletes. But the Olympics went professional in 1978. They expunged the word amateur from all their founding documents, and the rest of the world scarcely noticed. But we still cling to it in college sports, in part because of the halls of ivy and things like that, but mostly because the NCAA officials who are professionalizing college sports to the hilt demand that it be done on the backs of the essential labor without compensation.
There was a year, I think it was during the March Madness, that one team was, or at least officials were suspicious that one team of students was going to strike if they made it to the Final Four or the Sweet 16 or something like that. What happened?
Well, suspicious is not quite the word. They were terrified,
okay.
Apoplectic, that if UMass made it to the 1995 finals, that there was an agreement among the players that they were going to go right out on the court but then not come out when the national championship broadcast began. So that it would dramatize in horrifying detail for an obsessed country and everybody with millions of people with pools, betting pools at stake, that all this money and all the NCAA's revenue and subsidies for 1,000 schools rested on the uncompensated volunteer effort of five kids. Now, they didn't do it, but it would have been, and of course they would have been vilified if they did, and their school would have been vilified for letting them do it, and their coaches would have been called incompetent. But in fact, they would have just been waking up people to the underlying realities in college sports that allow exploitation to occur. What's not so, I mean, the Emmert sanctions against Penn State are trying to say that they're blasting Penn State. People gasp at them, but they're trying to say simultaneously that it's unique to Penn State and aberrant behavior by extremely bad individuals, but at the same time, it's going to fix all of college sports. You can't have it both ways.
Taylor Branch, thanks for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Taylor Branch, he's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author of a new book. It's called The Cartel, Inside the Rise and Imminent Fall of the NCAA. Still with us, Bill Rabinowitz of the Columbus Dispatch. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Wade Goodwin. Coming up on the next On Point, how to hack into any hotel room in the world and more. We'll go to the Black Hat Cybersecurity Conference in Las Vegas. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
And On Point is this afternoon from 1 until 2 on 89.7 NPR News. 86 degrees in downtown Columbus. Showers and thunderstorms are likely later this afternoon. Some storms could be severe. Expect a high of 96 today, but with the heat index, it could climb to as high as 103. Showers and thunderstorms likely tonight as well. Some of those storms could still be severe, a low of 71 degrees. Partly sunny with a chance of showers and thunderstorms on Friday, a high of 88. And cloudy for Friday night with still a chance of rain, a low of 67. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
We're talking about the NCAA and how it operates. Still with us, Bill Rabinowitz, sports reporter for the Columbus Dispatch, covers the Ohio State Buckeyes, and he's calling us from Chicago, where the Big Ten Media Day. Is it Media Day or Media?
It's actually Media Date, which is okay. A strange okay. Idea, but it's today and tomorrow, so it is Media Days. And it is a strange name, though, Ann.
That does not roll off the tongue. So, Bill, when you started covering sports, did you think of it in terms of covering something like an organization like the NCAA?
Well, my previous background was really covering the NFL, so when I came to the college side of things, it's quite different. The NFL, whatever its flaws and whatever, hypocrisy is not one of them. They are pros. They get paid. You know, the college game is everything's a gray area. You know, they're amateurs, but they're not. Trust me, the scholarship players at Ohio State work very, very hard to play for Ohio State. The demands on them are incredible, weightlifting and everything. I mean, it's just a lot of work. So anyone who says, well, you know, it's a free ride, it is not a free ride. They earn their scholarships. The NCAA, as anyone who's ever dealt with them, from a media side at least, it's a very exasperating organization. I tried not long ago to try to find out who there was a compliant or an enforcement person who worked for the NCAA who I was pretty sure was going to join Ohio State's compliance department. And I just asked the NCAA, you know, who among your staff is an Ohio State grad? They wouldn't. It's the runaround. And so when there's no transparency with an organization, you just feel like, you know, what are they hiding? It doesn't seem to make any sense. And so anytime they have a ruling, people are automatically suspicious of them because of that. and it damages their credibility. Now, they may be completely right in their decision and have the authority and all that, but as Taylor Branch said, the authority is kind of self-given. They've asserted themselves over the years, and I would highly recommend that anyone read Taylor Branch's story in the Atlantic Monthly. It ran last year, but I'm sure it's online.
Mm-hmm.
It gives the whole background of the NCAA. It's a brilliant story. But it's very maddening to deal with the NCAA, and I know it's hard for schools to understand what's going to happen. Ohio State was sure that they were not going to get a bowl ban based on the precedents of similar cases that had happened before. Well, Mark Emmert is the new NCAA head, and his idea is, there's a new sheriff in town. And I was in Indianapolis for an enforcement seminar last year or 2 years ago, and it was a mock seminar where we had this pretend case. But he talked to the maybe 30, 40 media people there, and he made it clear to us, he wasn't going to talk specifically about Ohio State, but he made it very clear that they were going to put the hammer down when they could. And I always thought when Ohio State was so sure that they weren't going to get slammed, that I thought they might, just because of Mark Emmert's attitude. And sure enough, they did. And the Penn State thing really opens up a whole new, whole can of worms, because the NCAA's enforcement staff, the enforcement provisions are designed to prevent competitive imbalance, so that a team, one school is not paying its players in the worst case scenario.
Mm-hmm.
There's not academic fraud. There's not those kind of things. To deal with essentially a legal issue, which the Penn State matter is at its core. I mean, it's a horrible, horrible thing, but it's not a competitive imbalance issue. That's a whole different thing. And for the NCAA to say, well, we're going to impose these unprecedented penalties, which it really is. In some ways, you can argue it's worse than having a death penalty, the so-called death penalty, which is when they suspend the program for a year or so or more. To take away the scholarships that they did, to impose a four-year postseason ban, that is an absolutely devastating penalty. And, there are people at Penn State who say, wait a minute, how did this happen? Yes, Sandusky's prosecuted as he should be. Other people have been fired. Why are you punishing the people who had nothing to do with it? And that's a legitimate argument. I mean, there's also the other side of it, which is the deterrent factor. If we do this now, then nobody will ever be tempted to let anything similar happen. But in terms of, if you look through the bylaws of the NCAA, there's nothing in their 426-page manual that even comes close to justifying this.
My guest is Bill Rabinowitz. He's a sports reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. If you have a question or comment for him, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Bill, I wanted to talk a little bit about the idea of competitive imbalance and that justification for the NCAA on that basis. Is it conceivable that back in 1998, or whenever these suspicions first arose about Jerry Sandusky at Penn State, that Joe Paterno or anybody at the university might have thought, you know what, we don't want this kind of publicity on our football program. It could hurt our football program if we have this kind of publicity. Let's just shove it under the rug.
Yeah, and I think that's the justification the NCAA is using. But it's not – usually the NCAA acts on specific – charges where it's clear from intent that a school was trying to gain a competitive advantage, by having a kid, allow him to cheat on a test, that kind of stuff.
And Jim Tressel not telling what he knew about the players
because they'd be ineligible.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that was at the forefront of Joe Paterno's mind or anyone at Penn State's mind. I think it was protecting the entire program. And absolutely, it was the fear that if this got out,
mm-hmm.
that it could destroy the program. So that's what the NCAA is using.
Mm-hmm.
But you could say that about a lot of things. I mean, it's just such a broad brush. You could say, well, if we knew this, then we could ban them or we could punish them for this or that. It's just unprecedented. But like I said earlier, it's unprecedented because the crime is unprecedented, and the NCAA decided that the punishment needed to be unprecedented.
You mentioned earlier trying to just get the name of an individual who might be joining the compliance staff at Ohio State, a graduate, OSU graduate who worked at the NCAA, and they wouldn't even divulge that. On a day-to-day basis, what's it like to work with the NCAA as a journalist?
Fortunately, I don't have to.
It feels like a day-to-day basis lately, but
yeah, it can be maddening because even simple things that you know is not going to hurt them. It would only benefit them if they were more transparent. And yet, even then, you get the runaround. It's frustrating. And I look at a guy like Greg Shaheen, who was the guy in charge of basketball, the basketball tournament at the NCAA, and he was a guy, a very bright guy, who opened up the process. I went to a mock bracketology thing where they show you the process by which they select the NCAA tournament teams.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a great process, and it informed and educated us. So the people who wrote about this stuff now had a really good idea, and we could disabuse people of their misconceptions about, oh, they won this matchup in the tournament, or this team got in and that team didn't because of, you know, some reason that wasn't valid. Well, for some reason, they let Greg Shaheen go at the end of last season. And it's stuff like that that makes you think, do they not understand how bad this looks? Because here's a guy who was helping them, who was well thought of by everyone who ever dealt with him, and they get rid of him, and they wouldn't even explain why. And it was just a strange thing. So it seems like the NCAA, anytime there's a push for transparency, it ends. And that is very maddening.
And it's not even a quasi-governmental organization.
That's right. They do not have subpoena power. So what happens in their investigations is coaches must comply. It's part of their contract. They must cooperate with investigations. But players whose eligibility has expired, they don't have to. In fact, there's absolutely no incentive to. Terrell Pryor did not cooperate with the NCAA. Current players have to, or they could, you know, be ruled ineligible. So you're dealing with an investigation that is at best incomplete because certain players will not talk, and they'd be smart not to talk if they don't have any eligibility left. So it's a very strange thing. I don't know how to explain it other than that.
An email from John, he writes, I get tired of hearing how it's unfair for the current and future players to be punished. My son went to West Point and I saw a couple of Army-Navy games. Those players weren't going to go pro and they weren't in the hunt for a national championship. But they were great games and the fans and players both seemed to have a great time. Penn State isn't being deprived of football for the next 5 or 10 years. They're just going to have to play it like most of the country, Indiana, Vanderbilt, Temple, Harvard, Tulane, etc. Is that so awful? I guess the implication, Bill Rabinowitz, is that these teams typically don't make it to the national championships either.
Well, that's true, but I think players that play for Army and Navy know that going in. They know going to the Naval Academy that playing for the national championships is very, very unlikely, and that's not why they're going there. They're going there for the education to serve.
In a career,
right. I feel sorry for, I'll say, the sophomores at Penn State. The freshmen who committed this year, who signed this year, knowing this had happened and knowing that at the very least they were facing uncertain times, I have sympathy for them, but not as much as, let's say, the sophomores who are, I don't want to say stuck there because they can transfer, but who went there having no idea that this was brewing.
Mm-hmm.
And they faced 3 years of no bowl, no championship. I mean, let's face it, players who go to Penn State or Ohio State go there for different reasons than players who go to Navy or Army.
I guess I understood or learned to understand a little bit differently about what the value of the bowl experience is. Sure, there's a lot of glory and adulation, but it's also more time on the field.
It is, but it's also players are competitive. They want to play for championships. Mm-hmm. And it's not just the bowl game. It's not being able to play for a championship, which Ohio State faces this year. They can't win the Big Ten. They may have the best team in the conference. Who knows? But they can't win the championship because they've been banned from a bowl and from the Big Ten championship game. So, yeah, the bowl is kind of the cherry on top of the sundae. It's a fun thing, and depending on the bowl, it's a big thing. But it's more that the players are denied a chance for a championship that really hurts them.
And going back to something that Taylor Branch said, they have no voice.
That's right. They don't. And you know, Terrell Pryor, for example, and I know he's kind of persona non grata around Ohio State, but, you know, those he and the others that were involved in that scandal, they didn't do it to spite Ohio State. They didn't do it for any reason other than they needed the money. I don't think they wanted to sell their stuff. I think that they felt like, given their economic circumstance, that was the right decision for them at the time. And most of them, if not all of them, regret that decision. They realized it was a mistake. But it's understandable given their age, given their circumstance. And, you know, Terrell Pryor had to see his number two jersey being sold at every bookstore. He didn't get a dime from that. And I don't think they realized at the time what they were doing was against NCAA rules. They should have known, and Ohio State should have made it more clear to them that it was against the rules. But that's why they did it. They did it because they didn't have a voice. They didn't have money in some cases, or enough money, and it's understandable. You know, I'm not condoning it. I'm not saying they did the right thing.
They broke a rule.
They broke a rule. Right.
NCAA President Mark Emmert said, and we had it at the top of the hour, that we are right now in the midst of a very large-scale reform in all of our dimensions of regulation and supervision of college athletics. What do we, the public, know about what that reform is going to be and what they're in the midst of?
I wish I had a good answer for you, and I don't know. And that's part of the deal, is that the NCAA doesn't tell.
And the universities as members aren't privy to it either?
I think they have a little bit more, but not a lot. I mean, when the sanctions against Ohio State came down, Ohio State didn't know until that day.
Mm-hmm.
And they were shocked. So, they may know an idea of the direction they want to go, but I'm not sure that they know the details at all.
And getting back to the issue of what Terrell Pryor and the others did with their I jokingly call it swag, but it's their memorabilia. Why give them that stuff?
Well,
in the first place, why not say you don't get it until you leave school or something?
I think it's just the normal human desire to reward somebody when it happens. You know, if you win a championship, you get a trophy when it happens, to say, okay, we're going to hold this in a warehouse for 4 years till you graduate or your eligibility's expired. I don't know. I mean, they may
the question is it their property or is it not their property?
Well, that was at the heart of everything. The players absolutely and their families thought it was their property. And Ohio State knew and should have informed them, educated their players that yes and no, it is. Yes, it's yours to have, but no, it's not yours to sell.
At least as long as you're a student.
As long as you're a student, right. And that's the other thing. It's, you know, as long as you're a student, you have a student athlete, to use their word, mm-hmm. you have certain rights. Actually, you have limited rights. And once you're done, it's not that you actually get those rights back. It's just they can't enforce any penalty.
And one of the lawsuits against the NCAA right now is whether or not the NCAA can use the likenesses
right.
and that sort of thing of the athletes, student athletes, once they're not students anymore.
That's a huge case. Ed O'Bannon, who played basketball for UCLA in the mid-90s, led them to a championship. He saw years later, I think it was, that his likeness was used to sell on the NCAA, I don't know what video game it was. He's like, wait a minute, why am I not getting a cut of this? This is me. And so he and many, many others, essentially a class action suit, sued the NCAA, and it's still going through the courts. And that case is a huge one, because if those players are determined by the courts to have rights and the NCAA or whoever, the video game manufacturers, have to pay them, that changes the whole ballgame.
Well, Bill Rabinowitz, thanks for taking the time to talk with us about this today.
My pleasure, Ann. Thank you.
Bill Rabinowitz, sports reporter for the Columbus Dispatch, covers the Ohio State Buckeyes. Coming up, we're going to talk about the Worthington Resource Center and food pantry and suburban food shortages. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Syria's two largest cities, pillars of the government, and isolated from the worst of the fighting until this past week. Government fighter jets rained bombs into the streets of Aleppo, while rebels took over parts of Damascus, at least for a while. I'm Neil Conan, a rare glimpse of life inside Syria. Next, Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation this afternoon from 2 to 4 on 89.7 NPR News. There are many ways to get the latest local news. You can follow WOSU News on Twitter or find WOSU on Facebook. Get headlines delivered to your email by subscribing to our Daily News Loop e-newsletter. Just visit WOSU.org/email to sign up. And stay right here in 20 minutes at 11 o'clock. Hour 2 of the program begins. And Lessons from Hollywood for Better Communication. That discussion from 11 till noon on 89.7 NPR News. 86 degrees with sunshine in downtown Columbus. Showers and thunderstorms moving into the area later this afternoon. Some of those storms could be severe. Expect a high of 96 today. But with the heat index, it could climb to feel like 103. Showers and thunderstorms for tonight as well. Some storms are possibly going to be severe, a low of 71. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
It started as the Worthington Food Pantry in 2009 with a handful of volunteers in a small building on the campus of the United Methodist Children's Home in Worthington. 25 families were served that first month. But the need increased as the economy continued to falter, and now there are more than 300 volunteers who last month served nearly 400 families, not only with food, but also with the resources families need to bolster themselves through hard times. With the growth, other changes have come about, including a name change to the Healthy Worthington Resource Center and Food Pantry, a location change to a building on the OSU Harding campus in Worthington, and a reorganization. Joining us now to talk about the changes and more to come is Deborah Gray Boyd. She's the new executive director of the Healthy Worthington Resource Center and Food Pantry, and also the first paid staff of the organization. Welcome to the show, Deborah.
Thank you so much for having me, Ann.
Also, the organization recently applied for a U.S. Department of Agriculture farm-to-school grant to pay for a mobile food pantry in the Worthington School District. That has not come to be yet. However, joining us to talk about the connection between Healthy Worthington and the schools is Trent Bowers. He's Assistant Superintendent of Worthington City Schools. Welcome to the show, Trent.
Hi, Ann. Thank you.
So the Farm to School initiative of the U.S. government, it's part of the Healthy Hunger-Free Kids Act. It provides access to local foods in eligible school districts. Why does this make sense for Worthington? Deborah?
Absolutely. We're a community pantry, and what that means is everyone's welcome who needs help, and also that everyone in the community can contribute. And the schools have been a huge part of that partnership and how we've been able to service as many families as we have. So when we were approached by the Worthington School District to go in with them on this grant and be partners, we were very excited about the possibility of being able to bring food to families by having a mobile pantry, which is what this grant was going to be applying for. So that transportation and getting to the pantry is one of the challenges that our neighbors have in accessing our assistance. And so this was going to be a big piece in making that more available to them by taking the food into their neighborhoods where they could access it more easily.
Trent Bowers, is the Farm to School initiative, is that just about mobile pantries or is it a larger effort?
Well, it's a larger effort. The mobile pantries is the school district's commitment to the Healthy Worthington Resource Center and Food Pantry. But it's really about empowering students to make healthy choices. It's about helping our students understand how they can make good choices for food, where food comes from, starting community gardens, getting fresh food to kids in the school, and then also into the hands of the community.
My guest, Trent Bowers, Assistant Superintendent at Worthington City Schools, and also Deborah Gray Boyd. She's Executive Director of the Healthy Worthington Resource Center and Food Pantry. If you have a question or comment, we're talking about suburban food insecurity. What do you think about that? Give us a call if you have an example, if you have a story to tell. We'd love to hear it. 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. Now, we've been talking about suburban issues for a couple years now. Deborah, it's not necessarily new, but what have you learned in the 3 years about what the needs are? Is it greater than or different than in some way than it was expected at the outset?
It's really been growing. In the last year, we actually have had over a 30% increase in the number of families that are coming to access services with us. And we have people coming who have never been to a pantry before to do anything other than donate food, donate money, or donate their time. This is not how their family understands and envisions how they are in partnership with pantries. And so getting over that perception is one of the challenges that we have in working with the Worthington community. We also have a large number of folks who have not only one, two, sometimes they have three or four jobs, and they simply are not making enough to put food on the table for their families. And so we're really there trying to help those folks make ends meet and learn ways that they might be able to increase their income and cover those needs for themselves.
By putting Resource Center in front of food pantry, you're emphasizing that. Why?
Because we are really committed to helping families access services and access education that can assist them in growing and learning and being able to do more for themselves. We are an official Ohio benefit bank site, which means that that is a common application for over 20 programs and services, both federal and state, that families might need to access as they transition into being more self-sufficient. Things like SNAP, which used to be called food stamps in my day, free and reduced lunch at the Worthington School District, also heating assistance, job placement assistance, unemployment, those types of things are all available through the Ohio Benefit Bank. And our volunteers sit down with our neighbors to help them walk through that process because it is a little cumbersome.
Trent Bowers, Worthington City Schools is going to be donating buses for the operation of the mobile food pantry when the grant, and if and when the grant is received, or approved. Where's the percentage for the district to do something like that? The free and reduced lunches is one thing, you know, nutrition, helping kids understand better what nutrition is, but where's the percentage for the district in a mobile food pantry?
I'm not sure what you mean by percentage.
Well, what's the benefit? Well, you know, what do they gain from it?
Well, from a district standpoint, you know, Worthington's free and reduced population in 2001 was 5%. In 2011, it was almost 27%. So we have a number of students and a number of families that have needs. The only benefit from a district standpoint is that we're trying to partner with our community to help our kids. And that's really part of what being a good school district is about, is helping our kids get the resources that they need so that they can come and be ready for school and have the nutrition that they need so they can make good educational decisions. We turn over buses on a fairly regular basis. We try to purchase 5 to 6 buses each year to make sure our fleet is maintained. We sell those buses at a very nominal cost. Part of what we're looking to do in this grant is to donate 2 of those buses and retrofit them to the food pantry. Also is to purchase a large walk-in freezer. And that freezer would then allow a number of things. But one of the benefits to the school district would be it would allow our local produce to be accessed and used better in the schools. It would also allow local produce to get out, fresh food to get out through the food pantry.
614-292-8513. If you have a question or comment, give us a call. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. Trent, have you noticed, obviously going from 5% to 27% over the course of 11 years is a lot. How do you manage that at the school level when you see kids are obviously not getting fed properly? There's the free and reduced lunch, but a lot of kids, particularly at the high school level, aren't interested in that.
That's one of our challenges. I mean, one of our challenges is to help our kids understand what's available at the school level. All of our schools offer breakfast programs as well as lunch programs for kids. We have pockets in Worthington. You know, we have several elementary schools, 3 that have free and reduced populations over 40%. One of them is over 55%. We really want to serve those pockets and make sure we educate those families and those kids so that they understand what's available to them. From a district standpoint, we have to look at our resources and look at what can we shift, what should we shift to make sure that we are providing supports where we haven't needed supports in the past. It's an issue that many of the first-rung suburbs are dealing with. Worthington's not the only one. The Columbus Dispatch ran a really good article in January detailing that change in the suburbs. But it is a paradigm shift. And one of the things that Healthy Worthington has done a really nice job of is raising awareness in our community. Because you can live in pockets of Worthington and not realize that that need exists. And so by tapping into the resource center and the food pantry and the awareness and the large fundraiser this Saturday at the Worthington Mall, it really helps everyone understand, hey, we have need in this community. And how can we help our neighbors to get better?
Deborah Boyd, what has it been like to try to raise money and raise funds and raise support for the resource center and food pantry? Because there is that community image out there that a lot of people still have of Worthington, that it's not one of those. It's certainly not alone. As you mentioned, Trent, the first rung suburbs are all of them are having the similar increases in need. But what's it been like to get out and tell people about it?
It has been such a blessing and so easy. The Worthington community has been hugely generous with the pantry. And while the percentage of children on free and reduced lunch has increased from 5% to almost 30%, that leaves 70% of the families in Worthington in a position to really be able to make a difference. And those families are taking this opportunity to educate their children about giving back to the larger community, about how we are all in this together, and how if there are children who aren't able to access food as readily and consistently and don't have that food security that their family does, that there's a way to share and make a difference. And so the community has come forth at the farmers market, and the community has come forth through the schools doing food drives. And the community has really been there at every turn as we have really gone through this radical increase in growth that has happened at the food pantry in the last 3 years.
Mike in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Mike.
Oh, good morning. Mike Rankin here. I just wanted to encourage all Columbus residents and Ohioans to get involved in the Operation Feed program that runs from about March to June at the Department of Public Safety for Ohio. We had a 37,000 meal goal. We raised over 260,000 meals in terms of money donations and the like. The Mid-Ohio Food Bank serves about 20 Ohio counties, and they just do an excellent job of supporting all these local food banks.
Deborah?
Absolutely. Mid-Ohio is a huge partner with us. Many folks don't realize, actually, that the pantry purchases food through Mid-Ohio, but we do so at a substantial discount. And so the average pound of donated food from the community that comes into our pantry costs that person about $1.60. With that same $1.60, we can buy 8 pounds of food. So we can really leverage folks' donations by buying food through Mid-Ohio. And we get all of our frozen meat through Mid-Ohio. But we also need community donations, and those really provide some variety to our neighbors who need those things. And then we also get produce from our community garden and through Mid-Ohio as well.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you, Ann.
Take care. You have a quick call. 614-292-8513 is the number to call. Trent, Worthington City Schools are going to be donating the buses for the operation of the mobile food pantry if the grant is approved. As far as you said retrofitting it, this district will do that as well?
Yeah, the district looks to retrofit the buses, help provide CDL license to the driver or to the drivers that are trained, which is part of driving a school bus. So the Farm to School grant would provide funding for that. It doesn't look like the deadlines for this particular grant are going to be met, but it is something the district is committed to funding. And finding grants like the Farm to School grant that will fund the retrofitting of these two buses, the donation of these two buses, and really the purchasing of the large walk-in freezer that will be needed to do the kind of things we want to be able to do, both for kids in Worthington schools, but also to be a partner with the food pantry.
Deborah, how would a mobile food pantry work?
So the vision is really, and it does start with this additional freezer and refrigeration space, because that is one of our challenges, is having enough space to store the food. But the idea was to have this mobile pantry be able to load it up and then drive it off to an elementary school after hours, obviously, park it in the parking lot, and allow neighbors to come through that mobile pantry very similar to how they come through our brick and mortar pantry, because really the transportation is an issue. And also, everybody's busy. And folks with food insecurity are usually doubly busy because they are working several jobs to try to make ends meet. And so getting the food to them in their neighborhoods makes a huge difference. And then after we were done servicing our neighbors, we'd take it back and unload it and get it ready for the next trip out.
Because Worthington has, its schools are very much neighborhood schools until you get to the junior high and high school level.
Yeah, absolutely. Our schools are kindergarten through sixth grade, and we really call them community schools because they're not traditional neighborhood schools where everybody walks to them, but they are the hub of community in Worthington. We have very strong school communities, and people relate to that. Their students are there for seven straight years. If you have multiple kids, you know, you easily can spend a decade in one school. So if the food pantry comes to that location, it's a very familiar location. It is usually much closer to the family. Hopefully a family could walk to that location if they have transportation issues or at least are heading to that location for another reason anyway. We think we can access more families that way.
Now, you mentioned earlier that the Worthington Healthy Worthington Resource Center and Food Pantry has planned a fundraiser for this Saturday. I'm going to be the MC. At the fundraiser.
Excited.
I'm hosting it. It's at the Shops at Worthington Place in Worthington. It's going to feature the music of an acclaimed jazz pianist, Bradley Soash. What else is going to go on, Deborah?
So we have lots of things going on. There is food. There are non-alcoholic beverages. There will be a cash bar. There are silent auction items. Everything from signed books and handmade scarves to order. To live auction items, including a lunch with you and a trip through the studio. So there are many things that are going on. We're going to be auctioning off a ride along with the police. So lots of fun things. Please consider coming and joining us from 7 to 10.
That's this Saturday. For more information, go to worthingtonfoodpantry.org. Deborah Gray Boyd, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Deborah's the executive director of the Healthy Worthington Resources Center and Food Pantry. Also, Trent Bowers, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Ann.
Trent Bowers, he's Assistant Superintendent for Worthington City Schools. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.